Welcome to the MIR podcast. I'm Kathy Posey, a director at MIR.
And I'm Ariana Yupi, Senior Project Officer at MIR. Our mission is open, public climate education, conversations that connect science, policy, and people.
Each episode, we bring together researchers, practitioners, and communicators to unpack what's really happening in the climate system and how we can respond collectively.
Expect clarity over hype, evidence over buzzwords, and practical ideas you can use. Find us on our social media or at MIR.org.
All right, let's dive in. Today, we're joined by Kyle Kimball, a legal scholar and climate policy analyst whose 2022 MIR Talk was one of our most talked about early episodes.
Back then, Kyle walked us through the inner workings of the IPCC, how national politics, economic models, and institutional culture all shape what becomes the official scientific narrative about climate change.
Since then, life has taken Kyle in new directions, including legal work and public service. But we're thrilled to have him back to reflect on how things have evolved, both in his own perspective and in the climate conversation at large.
Kyle, welcome. It's wonderful to reconnect.
Yeah, thank you so much for having me.
Kyle, it's been 3 years since your first MIR Talk, which remains one of our most shared discussions. Could you start by giving us a brief update? What have you been working on and how has life shifted since then?
Absolutely. So at the time, I was finishing my LLM at Rijksuniversiteit Amsterdam. And so I did finish that. I opened up a legal practice as a refugee and immigration lawyer. And I worked in that capacity for some time before last year moving back to the United States for a role in state government here in Washington. And I am now in a new role, but the general gist has been the same, you know, working on behalf of vulnerable populations.
Nice. Thank you. So you're looking at the climate situation now a little less from a research desk and more from the realities of institution and governments and how it affects those most vulnerable.
Yeah. And I mean, you see that, I think, at every strata. I mean, especially so I live in a very small town, but it is the capital of Washington. It's called Olympia. And very recently, due to budget cuts, the municipal government had this role for like climate program development. And as a coastal city, it's something that we should care about. But it was the first target in the most recent round of cuts. And so now you've got a city that is both actively sinking while the sea level is rising. And there's some infrastructure discussion, but nothing, you know, beyond that. And I mean, a bit concerning.
Absolutely.
Given everything that's happened globally since then, you know, record heat years, new IPCC reports, and intensifying extremes, what's your sense of how the climate conversation has evolved since 2022?
I feel like in some ways it's evolved in really positive directions as people just become, you know, you're being told something that doesn't match up with what your eyes are seeing. You know, I think a lot of people in this country and other countries are experiencing apocalyptic climate implications at a rate that has never been seen before. You know, these once a thousand years kind of storms are now happening every year. I mean, you look at this Category 5 hurricane that is now slammed into Jamaica. And this is going to keep happening. And the amount of energy that's in the system as a result of climate change is just going to continue to grow, you know, logarithmically. So while the public perception of climate change outside of those who were just like dogmatically opposed to opening their minds a little bit to the reality of the world around them, there's been a significant shift, at least in my perception. Unfortunately, at the level of state governance and corporate intrusion, things are the same, if not worse. You just look, you know, just what was it, yesterday or the day before, Secretary General of the United Nations, you know, we're never going to hit 2C. Maybe we can try to not go past 3C, but I mean, that's just an admission of defeat. I mean, that's not a survivable planet. So,
yeah, definitely agree. I think, you know, the people's response and the science, you know, those both have escalated, but it seems like the urgency hasn't been, you know, quite kept to pace. So yeah, I definitely agree.
Yeah, I think it represents in a lot of ways, I mean, an ontological shock, you know, because what it would require and what, you know, climate scholars who do not, you know, leave their discipline, people like James Hansen, for example, talk about how this is going to require a fundamental restructuring of the way that we live our lives. And since you cannot decouple, growth from the production of emissions, we have to degrow. We have to do active cooling, and all of these things are run completely counter to the way our economic system is structured.
Right.
Going back to looking at the IPCC, because you did so much work with that. When you look back on your earlier analysis of the IPCC process, the filtering, the negotiation, the economic framing, which of those concerns still feels most relevant today?
Oh, I mean, for me, it's a two-parter. It's the dominance of the IPCC by neoclassical economics. And you had Steve Keen, who also gave a tremendous speech. A lot of my work was inspired by the work that was done by Mr. Keen, Dr. Keen, I think, sorry. And so the fact that just this worldview of growth at all costs and domination by profit motive. I mean, yeah, capitalism is great if you like a million different kinds of peanut butter, but at the same time, we're all going to die. So pick your poison, I guess. The secondary issue is that the climate laws and legislation are written by lobbyists. I mean, in the one of the last COPs, I think if climate lobbyists were their own delegation, national delegation, that would have represented the largest national delegation. And these are people who are actively, showing up trying to influence plenary sessions so that decisions that are made by legislators, have basically nothing to do with the diminishing of, fossil fuel use, which, as we all know, that has to be a priority.
Yeah, absolutely. So we watch the natural world transform around us rapidly while the IPCC remains tied to its business as usual interests.
Yeah, I mean, and it scares people, right? Because to actually understand the scale of what we're looking at is to, I think, for a lot of people, give up hope, because it does feel like an incredibly hopeless situation. You've got governments in cahoots with corporations, and those two are in lockstep, and you've got the rest of us that have to, we don't have special bunkers, in New Zealand. We don't have the ability to
No, we
ride this out.
don't.
We have to just be here. It's scary.
Exactly.
Following up on that, the IPCC's credibility is a double-edged sword. It's, respectfully global, but that authority can also create complacency. So, do you think its voice still carries the right balance between authority and urgency?
I have never been one to criticize the IPCC of urgency. I think that is a charge that I could not lay at their table. The IPCC, by design, speaks in a very academic and dry way, and this is also a function of the fact that it comes from academia. The working groups submit, there's a certain number of reports that they select to view and studies that they select to view. And all of these, at every layer of science, you are told to basically not make waves. The idea is that if you start to make too many waves, then your funding's going to get cut. The NSF isn't going to give you a grant. So there's a lot of like hierarchy and power dynamics involved. I mean, especially now where the NSF and, the NIH are, functionally gutted. This has been the writing on the wall for a long time. So I think in terms of urgency, that hasn't really changed. The tenor of the publications that they put out, they are increasingly more, I think, cognizant of the reality. But keep in mind, they're still using models that call for overshoot. I think that that's okay. The idea being that we can, maybe we'll hit like 3 or 4 C, but don't worry, guys. There's this magical Deus Ex Machina technology that we can use that is going to eat all our carbon, which is, the violation of fundamental rules of physics.
Right, and our natural systems are getting less able to draw down CO2 as we warm.
Exactly. Yeah.
So.
So following up on that, if you could make one reform to help the IPCC, stay both credible and urgent, what would it be?
Oh gosh. I mean, its independence is something, or lack thereof, I think that would prevents it from being more legitimate as a source of information, because there's so many cooks in the kitchen and those cooks have vested economic incentives not to do anything. If there was a way for the IPCC to exist in a way sort of like, the Federal Reserve in the United States, which is like a holy sacrosanct like institution that operates outside really of like the boundaries of federal law, that would be helpful. I mean, I don't want to be too much of a doomer, but I also think that I feel very strongly that any faith that's placed in institutions that have existed for so long, predicated upon expropriation of resources of like the global South, for them to change course now would be, we can't appeal to their conscience. So either A, make the IPCC a fully independent organization that doesn't have to rely on like the funding and support of host nation or member nations to the United Nations or the Conference of Parties, or I guess in a way have it connected to systems of power that do not exist at like a federal level. Like I feel like there's states, for example, that are very well aware of this, California, Oregon, Washington, like coastal states, like even Florida, which no longer has, you can't get your properties insured in Florida because the damage is, the risk is too high. And when you lose the ability to like collateralize debt and disaster, the fabric of society falls apart. If you can't get things insured, then you can't take on the risk of like owning a property. The whole economy falls apart. They're not stupid. They know that. They just don't care because the short-term profits are going to outpace. So connecting those governance, like state level, I think would be far more effective. Talk to the people that care,
Definitely have that the independence and the governance. I think those would be, the two key ingredients for a more responsive IPCC. Thank you.
One thing we discussed last time was how language, words like likely or confidence interval, shapes public understanding. Do you still think language remains one of the IPCC's biggest bottlenecks?
It is certainly a contributor. And if you look at all of the way the framing of, what is functionally climate apocalypse has been one done in like very muted, passive voice. And that continues to this day. And so, like in my piece, when I did a bunch of research, is sort of like analyzing like the linguistic, the methodology that's used within all of these different working groups. That hasn't changed. So they're still doing the same thing. They're still, saying, oh, we think that there could be, this is, it's, and that's the thing, is that people just don't respond to vague uncertainty. As an ape, we are all but apes descended from trees. And so cataloging and sort of interacting with risk in general is really, really difficult for us just as a species. And so if you want people to pay attention, and if you want people to care, I think you have to come out with the big guns and say, like, look, in no uncertain terms, if we don't do something about this, there will be X million dead. These places will be uninhabitable. I mean, right now, for example, what Hansen describes as probably the greatest threat to global climate is the functional, the breaking off of the West Antarctic ice sheet. And the second that that does, that happens, we're talking about meters level rise in sea level across the globe. But the only people I know that follow this stuff, and there's active tracking of the ice sheet, are, nerds like me and climate scientists. And so it's not just the language, it's also like description of like trying to highlight some of the more immediately like jarring, I think, because oh, the GDP goes down. Like, people don't care about what that means. That doesn't mean anything. But hey, buddy, your home's going to be underwater in like 2 years. Like, that might scare someone.
Exactly. That's a good point because people think of, oh, 1.5 degrees Celsius. Oh, so what? It's a little bit warmer, but because they don't realize the implications of that to our climate system. Whereas, like you say, this could trigger, X number of feet or meters sea level rise. That would get many more people's attention, I think. So, yeah.
Yeah. And I mean, here in the United States, it's like you tell somebody what Celsius is, they'd look at you blankly anyway.
Well, that's true too. They don't realize that you have to double everything practically for Fahrenheit. So it's already worse if you frame it in Fahrenheit.
Yeah. I mean, I will contend, and this is I'm going to say somewhat supported by my research, but I would contend that the usage of these like arbitrary number targets, like 1.5, well, now it's 2, now it's 2.5, was intentional because it gives people sort of this idea of like a gradual path towards, functionally species extinction, when in reality it's like from 1.5 to 2C is like how many more tipping points, and then from 2 to 3, that's you're game over. At 3C, that's the end. So there will be like pockets, like enclaves that exist and survive in like a nightmare world, but not one you'd want to live in.
No, that's very true. That the exponential increase of disastrous consequences.
Yeah, at very small, like minute changes. And it's also not equivalent around the globe, right? You don't
True.
have like sea level rise is not the same. You think of the world as like a bucket of water, right? And so people perceive it as just like sea level go up universally. That's not how it works. So some places are worse affected than others, and as usual, it's mostly the global south. They get first.
Yeah. How do you think new communication players, such as independent scientists or educators or podcasts like this, or even projects like MIR, can help bridge that language gap?
Oh, I think it's huge. Because unlike, people that are playing the game at a level of like the IPCC, where there's a lot of politics involved and how you get to like, how do I get on this group? I have an ego, so I want to like be able to lead this thing. MIR and other communicators exist, I feel, largely outside of the constraints of ego. Like the only, and at great cost to self, right? Because having these dialogues puts you at, the risk of being targeted by very powerful, very wealthy interests. Fossil fuels in general have a long history of doing terrible things to activists, not only in the United States, but around the world. I mean, up to and including, murder. So I think that having like a greater population of like independent scholars that then find community with each other. And I think you find that on places like Blue Sky, now that Twitter has, functionally been entirely co-opted. And in universities, but also beyond them, because it's really highly technical stuff if you want to understand like the science of it. But you don't have to understand the science of it to really grasp, the implications that it has for just biodiversity on Earth and what that means for your daily life. And that's what like MIR and so many others are doing. And that's huge.
Yeah, definitely. It's about, the translation, taking data and turning it back to understanding, and also being able to, humanize a complex science behind it too.
Yeah, that's the big one because, there are so many people that are excellent scientists, but they aren't, maybe phenomenal communicators. And
Yeah.
what I've been seeing recently, like I developed recently like a weird little interest in particle physics. And so I'm trying to like it, I'm trying to find people who can communicate these very large, confusing concepts to me. And there's so many people now on YouTube, like Angela Collier or just so many people that are taking it upon themselves. At huge personal cost and effort to teach people. And I think the universe smiles on educators.
Yeah, definitely.
But Kyle, you've always linked climate science and justice. How does that intersection look to you now, especially after seeing institutions from both legal and environmental angles?
Oh my gosh. I mean, so my big thing is, especially, and this is not popular in my law life, but my big thing is that we don't really have a justice system. We have a legal system. And I think that you see that very acutely in the effects of like climate governance. And so now, compared to when we last talked, in what was it, 2022, 2023, it's only gotten worse. And I think access to justice or, any kind of like equity, at the highest levels, is increasingly becoming, a vanishing option. You hear stories of, Global South countries sending delegations to COP and being like flatly ignored. They can't get a seat at the table. Nobody cares about their story as like their island nation sinks into the sea. And then on an individual level, I mean, it is increasingly dangerous, especially here in the United States now that, they're weaponizing the Department of Justice against literally anyone that, disagrees with the platform of those that run it. As I still, it's hard to say. I mean, I want to be hopeful, right? And I try very, very hard in my personal life to maintain positivity, because negativity begets negativity, and then it feeds. And I don't want to be that climate doomer guy that's the sky is falling, and it's not productive. You reach people through love, not through fear. Or at least I choose to. But it is a task, and it is largely because access to concepts like justice is decreasing. I mean, as a refugee lawyer, right? You look at like what's happening in Europe with, Fortress Europa and all of the nightmarish murders that happen, turning the Mediterranean into the world's largest graveyard. Same thing here in the US. We're deporting people, US citizens even, to third countries where they disappear. It has never been a scarier time, I think, to do the right thing.
That's a sobering statement that I sadly agree with.
Yeah, unfortunately, it's like podcasts like these. It's like, I try to be joyous and have like good inflection in my voice. The content's a little dark.
Is, but we will, we too, we too at MIR, and I personally, and I know Ariana too, we all try to be optimistic too, because we have to. We have to act in a positive way, and that it's true. Fear causes paralysis, and we want to be active and working toward solutions. So there is, it is dark, but we're finding the light
I mean, and
in
I
it.
think it's one of those things where it's, all of us have like we have these ideas, and we know that if we could just get these ideas effectuated, then it would solve so many problems. But that's unfortunately not how the world works. And so once we're able, I think, to just sort of come to terms internally with like the you're not going to change everything. But really, like on a local level, your community, whatever and however that is defined, just being a good person in that community and fighting, for what you believe in and what you feel is right. That makes a difference. It has a ripple effect.
It does. Thank you.
Definitely, definitely. Thank you. I'm just gonna shift gears just a tiny bit. Given your distance from daily academic work, how has your perspective changed on how you interpret climate information now?
Oh yeah. So, oof. It is interesting because when you live it, it does become like a second language. And so I, at the time, was just knee deep in the literature. I was reading, super advanced, highly technical papers by the boatload on a daily basis. Now, I'm not gonna lie, looking at some of the math, some of the models, I linked, I think, the most recent Hansen paper in a bio, but looking at some of the math on that, it eludes me. I would need to spend more time, and that's just an unfortunate reality of, monkey brain, is that, what's in front of us is the thing that we are most aware of, and then as we move away from it, it becomes, it's like if it was a language, any kind of language, if you don't practice speaking a language, like I haven't practiced Dutch in, a year and a half, and my Dutch is accordingly not so good anymore.
Yeah, definitely, like also being, more selective in what you read, and also trying to focus on, bigger picture patterns rather than details. And it's just like, maybe stepping back and looking at the whole forest and not just the little tree branches or something like that.
No, that's true, because especially when you're writing like an academic paper, like what you're trying to do is correlate all of these little breadcrumbs that give you signals, and then create from that like a compelling hypothesis, which you can then test in different ways. And when you don't have that literacy, like it necessarily changes the aperture of information. And so I think that's true for anyone, which is why I think it's so important to have access to, science communicators operating in good faith, that it's not like they're dumbing it down. They're just, that there's just a level of awareness that different people have. And I think speaking to people with, a level of awareness that is not where they're living in a library, 24/7, that is huge. That makes a big difference.
Yeah, definitely.
Kyle, if you were going back to the IPCC again, if you were to summarize what the IPCC gets right, what still makes it valuable? What would that be?
To me, I think it is still incredibly valuable to have a organization which sits at the nexus of international governance that is largely entrusted to be the mouthpiece of scholars who can never even dream of getting close to the gears of power like that. And so it does, for example, the fact that the IPCC exists at all is what made it possible for me to even correlate, the way that government controls these dialogues and the way that, like, sometimes the science is methodologically unsound. You have to have the thing to be able to know, hey, maybe these processes that are reflected in other parts of our world are not something that we should aspire to. So I do think that the IPCC has value. I think that, yeah, that value is the elevation of science. And the introduction of science to a population that maybe, may not otherwise seek it out or find it, because it's, it's a bullhorn. It's a loud bullhorn. Like, when the IPCC says something, like, people hear it, and across the globe. Now, is it good information that's coming out of the bullhorn? Not great, but it is something people can communicate and understand. So that's good.
That's true. That is good. Thank you.
Okay, finally, what should listeners remember about all of this, the politics, the process, and the science?
I think what's most important to remember is you can believe your eyes, and that you can believe your anecdotal experience of, like, your natural environment, the place that you live. Pay attention to the seasons, pay attention to what's happening around you. Do you remember things were differently, maybe even 5, 10, 15, 20, 25 years ago? And be curious. I think for me, there was a long portion of my life where I was, like, very dogmatic in my approach to the world, very, like, ego driven. I'm so smart, like, every nobody else knows. And I think breaking free of that, and just having an open mind, being very curious, I encourage curiosity. Like, I love absurdity, I love whimsy, and I love curiosity. And I think being a silly little research goblin is a cool thing to be.
Yeah, I definitely think staying curious is a big component. And also reading critically too. I think that's a very important tool too.
Yes, actually reading. Yes, stop using AI, use your brain.
Yeah. Yeah, thank you.
Well, and in a way, maybe you kind of just said this, but maybe you can elaborate or put a different twist on it, because so we have a segment we tr in our podcast that we always do that's called Try This, where we leave listeners with something actionable. What's one simple thing people can do to better understand the science behind the headlines?
I think the simple thing is to go to the source. And if you can look at just, like, for example, the introductions and then the conclusions of papers by people like James Hansen, Steve Keen, you skip a lot of the really technical stuff that gets you there. And those, and the introductions and conclusions are always written with, a more lay audience in mind. And so that's a really good source to go. You skip all the BS, you skip through all of, like, the government control or, like, the filtering of information. Go to the source, read the top and bottom. You'll have your information.
Thank you. That's a great tip.
That is a good tip. That's something I've always done in my undergrad and grad school too. When I go through like scientific articles where it's like super complex, I'm just like introduction, conclusion, discussion.
Yeah, because even, it gives you the ability to have the curiosity to read further. Like, if you read the introduction and the conclusion, now you know enough to at least navigate through the rest of it if you so choose. But if you don't, you're just, oh, this is overwhelming. So it's
Yeah.
easy to get overwhelmed, and it's totally valid, but there's ways around it. Introduction, conclusion.
We have another quick segment called Myth versus Measurement. What's one myth about the IPCC you would like to retire, and what's the reality?
The myth I think that most people operate on is that the IPCC is dominated and governed by scientists. That is unfortunately not the case. People like Dr. William Nordhaus, who've designed a number of models that are used by the IPCC, certainly started in science and then shifted disciplines into, neoclassical economics. And yeah, the myth, people see the IPCC as like this beautiful mouthpiece of science, so they just assume that it's run by scientists. It's definitely not. It's dominated by governance and it's dominated by economists. And economists, the way that economics works is that you design models like, wow, this is crazy. The data is fitting the models that we designed. It's like, well, you designed it to fit. You started with all these assumptions, and then like those assumptions don't make any sense in like observable reality. So that would be my big one. Like, treat it as it is. Treat it as a economics agency that happens to have scientists working for it, and not a science agency that has some economists on staff.
Yeah, it's not absolute truth. It's a carefully negotiated consensus. Yeah, it definitely makes sense.
And Kyle, I have to thank you because that was my takeaway from your Mir talk 3 years ago, was while I knew that politics were involved, I guess you helped me realize the degree to which they control it,
Oh, I'm
and
glad.
that the science piece is so buried and so diluted.
It is. I mean, and you think about it, just like the way that their methodology functions, not even with the studies that they use, but just like the selection of papers, what information is decided to go to the different working groups, who then becomes like lead coordinator, it's all of these like human political decisions that dominate like the management of the entire entity, and not so much, the science, which in my mind is what it should be.
Right. Kyle, what still gives you hope about climate communication and reform?
I think I feel very strongly that we are approaching a point of a major turning point, like a point of inflection as a people, as a species, because the warning sound, the alarms are getting too loud to ignore. And I think as people start to increasingly encounter scarcity on having to be a nomadic, resident of their home state, as the flow of refugees increases exponentially, I don't like saying flow of refugees, as refugees begin to seek asylum in different countries, safer places, I think it forces two things. One, it forces people to sort of encounter their role, maybe as a member of like the global north in the creation of this global polycrisis. And secondarily, I think it just, it really, it comes as it shocks you out of complacency. And so I am hoping that that shock does not come well after, there's like five of us sitting around a fire, like, oh, that was really bad, huh? We did it. Maybe we should have done that differently, that whole being industrial revolution thing. But no, I do have hope that as people become more aware, science communication fills sort of that gap where there's usually uncertainty and fear, because knowledge gives us, at least a way to grasp our environment. And that's very important. And that gives me hope.
Right. And a way to respond, that knowledge gives us a way to respond strategically and effectively as possible,
A
as
thousand
effectively as
percent. Yeah, I mean, you can't do anything without good data, right? So if you're getting bad data, you're getting bad data, then all your, solutions that stem from that are going to also be bad, or at least code in all of those errors. If you're getting good data from honest science communicators, then you can actually make decisions for your own life. I know, at least in my area, we're very lucky to live in the Pacific Northwest, which to me is like one of the most beautiful places on earth. But we're in my community, we're taking it very seriously. Like, I have friends, we are getting water storage figured out, we're getting food production figured out, we're building gardens at each other's homes. Like, It's a collective community effort, and I think a lot of that is only possible because science communication as people wake up.
Kyle, is there anything else that we haven't asked you that you would like to share?
Oh my gosh, no. I mean, I'm so grateful for the opportunity to speak with y'all. It's always a pleasure to meet and engage with people that are also, that care. And I think for me, we are taught through our whole lives that caring is a sign of weakness and vulnerability. And oh, like, you're not trying to, why aren't you trying to like make your most profit? Why aren't you trying to, do what's best for you? And I think that just collective community consist like consensus decision making is so important. So I appreciate the opportunity to be a part of that and what Almir is doing.
Thank you.
Thank you.
It's we're really happy that you came back after several years to help us revisit all these crucial topics with your unique perspective and such honesty. So thank you.
Yeah, honesty good. I think we should be honest.
Definitely, yeah. So listeners, you'll find links to Kyle's original Mir Talk and resources on the IPCC process in the show notes. Please read, share, and think critically.
If this conversation helped you understand the climate picture and the systems behind it, please follow the MIR podcast, leave a review, and share it with someone who'll benefit.
MIR is listener-supported. Your donations power public education and our ground-based cooling projects. Contribute at mir.org/donate.
Thank you for listening. We'll be back with more voices from the global climate and science community.
See you next time.